you are standing and confessing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing educators and activists to campuses and communities across America to engage in meaningful dialogue about the pressing issues that confront our country and the world. If you enjoy the program, one way you can express your support is to become a monthly patron and sustainer of the show by signing up at www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can pledge as little as $2 a month or as much as you'd like, and not only know that you're supporting our efforts, but also gain access to bonus content, like premium commentaries on the events of the week, as well as signed books or DVDs. And all donations are tax deductible as they go directly to Speak Out to support their nonprofit activist mission. You can also make a one-time donation to the program at speakoutnow.org via PayPal, and make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Hello, everyone. Tim Wise here. Welcome to Speak Out with Tim Wise on Wednesday, April 15th, as I am recording this. I am old enough to remember when this was known as Tax Day, but it isn't this year because of the pandemic. We get 2 extra months to get our tax forms in, which is nice. One less thing to worry about in the midst of this thing, although I'm not convinced that 2 months is going to be enough. It's still going to be pretty stressful, I'm sure, for millions of us to get our taxes done. It's just a reminder of all the income that many folks around the country, ourselves very much included, and our family are losing in this moment. Not necessarily the greatest exercise for mental and emotional health, having to do your taxes in the midst of a complete economic freefall, but I digress. It's not the thing I want to talk about today. We're about 3.5 weeks in here in Nashville, Tennessee, into at least our family's self-imposed quarantine and shelter-in-place process. It's been going reasonably well. I hope it has been for you. We have 2 high school students, 1 a senior, 1 a sophomore, and, you know, they're doing about as well as, you know, it can be expected under the circumstances. You know, in the midst of this lockdown, where, as I said, we have these 2 high school kids, fantastic young people, 18 and 16 years old, and we were on a call today with their school, and just really want to express some gratitude to their administrators and the teachers at their school and other parents who were trying to hold it down with their kids in the midst of what is obviously a very chaotic and difficult time. You know, it's really what I want to talk about today is gratitude. And you may think that's not a particularly political or ideological discussion, and this is a political and ideological show, but I promise you, I'm gonna connect the dots between the generic concept of gratitude and our current political moment in just a few seconds. But before I make that connection, I just want to speak in very general terms about gratitude. When you think about this moment, yeah, especially when you have kids, as we do, who are high school students, or they don't even have to be high school, they'd be middle school, elementary school, whatever, you really begin to see, if you didn't already, and I think many of us did, but if you didn't already, you're certainly beginning to see now just how incredibly indispensable professional educators are. You know, we don't give teachers nearly enough credit. We certainly don't pay them enough money, but we don't give them enough credit for the difficult work that they do. I'm sure many of you have seen, there's a ton of sort of funny TikTok videos and YouTube videos going around where parents are getting online and talking about, oh my God, this is incredibly hard and we don't know how you do it. And you know, I was talking to my buddy today, my best friend, since we're, you know, 5 or 6 years old, Albert, who's a professor in the School of Education at Cal State Los Angeles. And we were talking like literally an hour ago about, you know, this phenomena of parents starting to realize how tough it is to be a teacher. And they're, oh my God, how do you keep all the, you know, how do you keep my kids in line? And it's not just your kids, parent. You've got your kid or your two kids or three kids or whatever, and you're having a hard time keeping them focused, and they're yours and you love them. Right? Now imagine being a teacher who's got 25 of those or 30 of those or whatever it is, and they ain't their kids. They're your kids. They're my kids. They're the person down the block's kids. They don't have to love them, but they do anyway. They don't have to even like them, but they have to work with them. And that's where we are right now. And so parents are now getting a taste of, I mean, a really small taste of how tough it is to not just dispense formal knowledge and information, which is part of what teaching is, right? It's the dispensing of information into the brains of children, or the eliciting of wisdom from children, which is a much more important part of it that we sometimes overlook. But it's also the creation of community. It's the creation of dialogue and interaction. And also for a lot of people, it's the creation of stability. There's a stabilizing force, a stabilizing communal force that that professional educators create. And it's really hard. And parents are starting to see that, right? And so I hope that we are developing in this moment a new sense of appreciation and gratitude for the work that teachers do, and that school administrators and counselors and all these folks who are trying to figure out, you know, in this moment, how best to do what they do, what they are able to pull off. It's really quite extraordinary. In addition to that, of course, I want to also note the gratitude that is owed to so many other folks who we oftentimes don't pay enough respect to. You know, in this moment, we are beginning to see, aren't we, just what are the essential, indispensable jobs that we maybe didn't realize were essential and indispensable. It's not the Wall Street investment banker, that's for sure. It's not the high-priced attorney, that's for sure. Who are the indispensable workers? Well, they're physicians, and physicians do get paid pretty well. But among the indispensable jobs right now are an awful lot that don't get paid very well. They certainly don't get rewarded financially. They're not as well remunerated as physicians are, even though they're awfully important. Nurses who are in those hospitals and in those clinics every day right now, exposing themselves potentially to coronavirus, but also trying to save our family members, our friends, maybe us, ourselves, from this pandemic, from this virus. You have not just the doctors and the nurses, the latter of which should certainly be compensated quite a bit more than they are, but you also have the orderlies at the hospital, the people on the maintenance crew who are disposing of the medical waste, all of whom are exposing themselves to the virus, the folks that work in the cafeterias of the hospitals, the folks that work at the desk and check you in at the hospital. Right? These are not high-paid folks, but they're exposing themselves, and they're doing a job that's very dangerous, and it's one that I dare say many of us wouldn't want to be doing right now. And so we have to have a real debt of gratitude to them. And then you move beyond that, and you see the folks who are, you know, my wife and one of our daughters right now is at the grocery. And who are the folks working there? Well, they are folks who are stocking the shelves, keeping the food available for us to go and purchase in the first place, the folks at the registers who are exposing themselves to potential danger, again, just to keep us fed. It's the people who drive the trucks that get the food and other items to those stores. It's the folks who work in the processing facilities where that food is churned out, put on the trucks, and then taken to the grocery. You know, these are all individuals, many of whom don't make a whole hell of a lot of money, but who are doing work that is right now among the most important work being done in the country. The same is true with the guys that 15 minutes ago drove down the alley in the back of our house in our neighborhood and hauled away our garbage, right? Two guys who got out of their truck and put the garbage in the truck that they were driving and drove to the next house and did the same. And they're going to do the same all throughout the neighborhood. I don't know for sure what they make, but I guarantee you that whatever it is not commensurate with the value that they're providing right now. And by the way, the value that they provide every day. Those who have listened to my talks know that I oftentimes will discuss the value of sanitation workers as opposed to, let's say, pharmaceutical sales reps or stockbrokers, investment bankers, right? Whatever value you think investment bankers and those kind of folks provide to the world. And I would argue it's not very much, but whatever value they think that they provide and whatever value you may allow that they provide, it certainly pales in comparison to the importance of the sanitation workers who pick up the garbage at your house. Because if they don't show up to work for 3, 4, 5 weeks, couple of months, whether it's in the middle of a health crisis like the pandemic, or whether it's just, because they go on strike or because they just decide not to come to work that day, you're going to have disease outbreak on your block. You're going to have a health emergency in your community, even when there isn't a global health emergency already happening. Which of these is more important? It's pretty obvious the sanitation workers are more important, but depending on where you live, their pay and their benefits certainly don't reflect the value that they bring to the community. Now, in some places, sanitation workers get paid decent money. Still, I would say not what they're worth to us all, but they might have a good union contract. Certainly, that's true in a lot of northeastern cities. But here in the South, places like Nashville, the folks who do that work tend to not be unionized. They tend to not make what would really constitute a livable wage with really strong benefits. And so really, of course, what they're getting paid and what their benefits are is not reflective of the value they produce. It's not reflective of some sort of inherent invisible hand free market mechanism, right? It's the result of the power relationship between workers and city managers and elites. And so in places where the sanitation workers are unionized, they have more power. They have the power of collective bargaining. In places where they're not unionized, they don't. In places where that stuff is contracted out by the city, they have even less power than in places where they might be considered actual municipal employees, right? So it's all about power dynamics. That's nothing to do with inherent value. And that's by the same token, the reason why the investment banker makes so much more. It's why the pharmaceutical sales rep makes so much more. It's not because they're necessarily providing the greatest value to the society, but it's because they happen to produce a good or service in that case that rich people are willing to pay a lot of money for. And as a result, they end up, reaping huge amounts of benefits. But if you were to make a list, and I've encouraged people to do this, and I'll encourage my listeners to do it now. If you were to make a list of, the 10 jobs that you think are just like the most important, most valuable jobs in the society. And I don't just mean now in the midst of a pandemic and in the midst of COVID-19, but I mean in general, the jobs that you consider to be on a regular basis the most important for society. My guess is if you were to make that list and then you were to go and you can look up, this data is readily available, you were to look up the 10 most lucrative jobs, the jobs that pay the best in this country, there will be a little overlap, but not much. Guarantee that the top 10 in terms of social utility, the kind of thing that most people would say are the 10 most valuable jobs, hardly any of those are going to be on the list of the 10 most lucrative jobs. Probably the only one that would be a physician. But other than physicians, most of the jobs that are going to be on your top 10 list of most valuable jobs, most important jobs, are not going to be among the highest paid. Maybe the only other one that would be like a structural engineer, right? Structural engineers, obviously very important to making sure the bridges don't collapse, and that the roads are functioning and things of that nature. But that's a well-paid job. But the other ones that tend to be on people's list when I've asked them to do this, they'll say nurses. Well, nurses certainly are not particularly well paid, not certainly commensurate with the value that they produce and the benefits that they bring to the society. People say teachers, they'll say childcare providers, they'll say elder care providers. Think about folks right now who work in our senior facilities, right? And these are the sort of the locus of a lot of the coronavirus outbreak around the country have been, particularly in those spaces where you have such vulnerable populations. Folks that are going in, like elder care staff in senior facilities are some of the lowest paid. It's sort of shocking when you look at the typical pay. I used to know this number, and I think that number is actually in my 2015 book, under the affluence. I think I actually mentioned this number. I don't have it in my head, and I don't have the book in front of me to grab and sort of look up the footnote. But I mean, it's something in the neighborhood of maybe $21,000, $22,000, $23,000 a year, right? Which, even putting aside the risk of the pandemic, right? Putting aside the specific moment that we're in, that is absurd. It really says a lot about how we view our parents and grandparents. We put them in places and we pay people $20,000 to take care of them. What does that say about not just how we value the worker, but how we value the people that the workers are taking care of, who are our own parents and grandparents? I mean, it doesn't reflect particularly well on our culture, the values of our culture, right? And so it says a lot that we say we value that job. And if you ask people to make a top 10 list of the most valuable jobs, they will often put those folks there. But then we look at what they actually get paid. And what that tells us is that our society doesn't really view value the way that most people in the society value things. I've often made the argument, even though I know it's a little unappealing, that if old folks all managed to shit out one 10-carat diamond upon turning 90 years of age, elder care workers would in fact be paid like investment bankers, because there would be an inherent market interest in keeping old folks alive long enough for the diamond harvest. Well, you got to pay them. You know, we got to get that 10-carat diamond. Well, you know, it's a valuable resource, so we got to keep those old people alive. You know, not because they have inherent value as human beings, but because, you know, they're going to shit out a 10-carat diamond in a few years. So, right? That's the society we live in. Not the one that we, in our own heart of hearts, would prefer, but the one that those with power prefer, and that they're willing and able to pay for. So we need to have real gratitude for all those folks whose value is so much not reflected by the way that we compensate them. Now, I want to talk a little bit about gratitude as it relates to our politics right now. So I want to sort of pivot and make the connection, because we are in the middle of a presidential campaign. And obviously, the current president of the United States does not show very much gratitude to anyone. He wants gratitude for himself. He wants people to be grateful for him. He has just announced, for instance, as of yesterday, the Treasury Department has announced that they are going to require the president's signature to be on every one of these stimulus checks that are going out. Obviously, a lot of people are going to have their $1,200 per adult is going to be deposited via direct deposit, but there will be hundreds of thousands or maybe millions of others who will be receiving actual physical checks in the mail. And Donald Trump insisted, and the Treasury Department has agreed, that they will put his name on the check, as if the United States of America is an extension of the Trump Organization, where his name would obviously appear on the checks. And of course, that's how he views the country, is as an extension of the Trump Organization. He wants gratitude. He wants people to see that name on the check and then associate him with whatever relief they're receiving so that they will be grateful to him. Of course, the irony of this is that that $1,200 per adult stimulus is so inadequate, right, that it's probably not going to pay bills for 2 weeks for most people. So hopefully people will get their paltry check that doesn't cover even 2 weeks of bills. They'll look at the name and they'll realize what cheap ass screwed them. So it may backfire on him, but his entire desire to have it on there is so people can be grateful. So he doesn't have gratitude for others. He's never once thanked the folks in the public health community, the infectious disease research community, the doctors, the nurses, the frontline healthcare workers. He hasn't thanked any of them in his press conferences. He hasn't talked about the amazing value that they provide. He spends his press conferences talking about all the great stuff he's done. So we obviously don't have a lot of gratitude, let alone humility, coming from the top, but we need some right about now. And so what I want to talk about today is the importance of gratitude and humility as opposed to guilt and shame as political motivators, because it strikes me that a lot of our current political organizing and electioneering, and I'm going to talk now specifically about on the left, those of us within the liberal left progressive community, very, very big concept, I realize, and it stretches all the way from the Democratic Party over to folks far to the left of the Democratic Party, which I consider myself to be. But even just within the orbit of, let's say, the mainstream, quote unquote, Democratic Party that is apparently moving forward with Joe Biden as their presidential nominee, compared to, let's say, the hardcore Bernie Sanders supporters who were still very hurt and disappointed by the collapse of the Sanders campaign and the capitulation of the Democratic Party to what they view as, sort of this neoliberal centrist, center-right candidacy of Joe Biden. Just even within the Biden versus Bernie Sanders orbit of the left, there is a lot of acrimony right now, and a lot of attempting to shame and guilt people into doing various things, as opposed to using other tools like gratitude and humility to try to get people to do things, right? Because when you're trying to organize politically, whether it's a social movement or whether it's on behalf of a political candidate, you have choices to make about the approach that you take in order to persuade someone to do what it is that you want them to do. And guilt is one way to do it, I suppose. Shaming them is one way to do it. And then there are other ways. A little bit of humility, a little bit of gratitude can go a long way. And so I want to compare and contrast these, because it strikes me that there are people on both sides of the Biden-Bernie divide. And we'll just keep it at that. I mean, again, I know there's a large universe of the left that's, above and beyond those two, but I just want to keep it at that for now, because that's the political dynamic that we find ourselves in the middle of. There are people on both sides of that divide who are leaning far too heavily on the guilt and the shame approach in the hopes that that will work on the other side of that divide, rather than using gratitude and humility. And I want to talk about why that's a problem. Now, first, let me give you the examples of what I mean. On the one hand, we know, for instance, that among the Biden supporters, the sort of, the Democratic Party faithful who are behind Biden, there is a lot of shaming and guilting and, in some ways, implicit threatening of Bernie Sanders supporters, right? Trying to shame and guilt them into supporting Joe Biden by suggesting, well, if you don't, you'll be the reason Donald Trump gets 4 more years. You should be ashamed. You'll be to blame. We will blame you. In fact, we're already blaming you for even contemplating not voting in this election, or voting third party, or writing Bernie Sanders in, or whatever the case might be. So this is an attempt to shame people, right? And the Bernie supporters, the hardcore Bernie base, have been pretty animated on social media about, pointing out, number one, sort of screw you, and number two, that's not really going to work. Why would you think that approach is going to work? And then, of course, they then recapitulate all their arguments for why they shouldn't be guilted and shamed into supporting Joe Biden when Joe Biden, in their mind, violates so many of their core moral and ethical principles as a candidate, as a human being, perhaps, and as a candidate and as a political leader. Of course, I should say that the majority of people who were Sanders backers, including the majority of his, hardcore base of support, actually are, in all likelihood, going to vote for Joe Biden. They are not mostly threatening to abstain. So I don't want to give the impression that's necessarily most of the Sanders hardcore base. It's a segment of them, right, who are suggesting that, or at the very least saying it to the point where the Biden folks feel that they need to be guilted or to be shamed. And it's that dynamic. It's the one subset of Sanders supporters being attacked, being ridiculed, being shamed, being guilted by a segment, again, of the Biden supporters. And then on the other side, you have the Bernie folks who don't get off scot-free on this charge either. They may think that only the Biden folks use guilt and shame, but no, that's not true. The Sanders supporters and the harder left also use guilt and shame. We saw it all during the primary season, where you had Sanders supporters on platforms like Twitter who basically were saying things to anyone who wasn't a Sanders supporter, anyone who was in any way critical of Sanders, or not even just critical of Sanders, just anyone who was a partisan of one of the other candidates, that, well, they obviously don't care if people die because they can't afford insulin. You obviously don't care that tens of thousands of people are dying because they don't have Medicare for All. And if you're opposed to M4A, then you don't care if tens of thousands of people die. You don't care that insulin is unaffordable. You don't care that the planet is dying. You don't care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, about all these things. And that's also the deployment of shaming. That's about saying to somebody who doesn't see the world the way that you see it, or doesn't see the election the way that you see it, for whatever reason, reasons that you don't necessarily know, that, well, you obviously are just a cold-hearted, asshole who doesn't care about the well-being of people. Just like the Biden folks who were saying to Bernie supporters, hey, you should vote for Biden because Trump is horrible. It's like you're saying, well, you don't care if he stacks the Supreme Court even more, and you don't care about kids in cages that he's putting there, and you don't care about all the stuff that he's doing that's so horrible. And the reality is, this approach is not rooted in reality, right? The idea that Bernie Sanders supporters don't care about the damage that Donald Trump has done and will continue to do is ridiculous. If you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, by definition, you get that Donald Trump is poison, right? Like, that's not really a revelation to anyone who's going to vote for Bernie Sanders. I mean, there might be a handful of, people who were Trump people who would have come over to Sanders. But for the most part, even if they did that, it would be because they had come to the conclusion that Trump was toxic, right? Most people, certainly the left, supporters of Bernie Sanders, which is 99% of them, already know that. So the idea that they don't care, that's not true. And the idea that somehow Warren supporters and Biden supporters and Kamala Harris supporters and, whomever, Pete Buttigieg supporters, that they don't care about the price of insulin, they don't care that people are dying from lack of healthcare. Really, do you actually believe that? Can we just sort of step back from the insanity of that kind of charge and acknowledge that no, it's not that, right? That what you have here is you have two sides of a left community, liberal left community, who see the practical politics of this moment differently. You have a group of people who believe that a more revolutionary and radical transformative politic is necessary and attainable in this moment. And you have another group of people who believe that a more incrementalist approach is better in this moment. These are strategic differences. There really are not huge moral differences and ethical differences in terms of what people on both sides care about. Now, obviously, look, there are some people in the Biden camp who are never Trump Republicans, who would love to be able to go back to the pre-Trump Republican Party, which those of us on the left would say is not acceptable. That's different. There are, I'm sure, some people on Wall Street who would prefer Joe Biden just for the stability that, mainstream neoliberalism offers, as opposed to the up-down swings and nuttiness that is the Trump administration. There are probably some investment bankers who think, that they're on board with Biden because they just think he'll be more consistent and more predictable. I'm not talking about them. Their particular politics, their ideology, their ethics, the things they care or don't care about, I don't know. But for the vast majority of people who are going to vote in this election for Joe Biden, they are, in fact, quite concerned about those things. They just believe, rightly or wrongly, that this over here is the way to get from point A to point B. And the Sanders supporters are also deeply moved and concerned about what damage Trump can do, but they just believe, for one reason or the other, that this over here is the better way to get there. So all of the guilt and the shaming is all rooted in a false assumption anyway. But it's also not effective. Like, when was the last time that you use guilt and shame and it worked? Like, when was the last time that you decided, I'm going to accuse you of being a horrible human being for voting the way that you vote or for thinking the way that you think? And then the person that you did that to, had the figurative light bulb pop over their head and they looked at you and they said, oh my God, thank you for demonstrating to me what a total evil asshole I've been all of my life. Like, that never, ever happens, right? Using shame and guilt is not really about converting anyone from point A to point B or making them rethink. It's just about performative radicalism. It's just performative wokeness, right? It's about demonstrating to one's own self one's moral superiority. That kind of guilting and shaming doesn't work. It doesn't work in a non-political setting. If you were doing an intervention on someone who was an addict of some kind, yeah, you would talk about the harm that they were doing to their family and their loved ones. And there's a little bit of guilt maybe and shame that's associated with that. But you wouldn't just do that. You would also talk about how much you loved that person. You would talk about how much that person meant to you. You would talk about all the great things that you know about that person when they're not using, when they're not abusing, when they're not strung out, when they're not in the throes of their sickness. You would use compassion and you would use humility and you would use love and you would use gratitude for the person that you know them to be deep down, not just the guilt trip, not just the, don't you see how this is killing your parents? Like, that doesn't work with kids when you send them off to rehab. Like, no kid who ever got sent off to rehab by their parents ever gave up their addiction because the counselor sat him down and said, "Don't you see what you're doing to your mother?" I mean, that doesn't work. There has to be more than just guilt and shame in general. And that's just about human psychology. No one wants to be made to feel bad, whether it's for personal reasons or for political reasons. Now, someone might say, well, but it does work sometimes. Sometimes when we feel guilty about something or, you know, we feel ashamed of something, we do change our behavior. Yeah, it sometimes works in the short run. In the short run, that is true. But I want to suggest to you that when it comes to politics and building movements for a more liberatory society, a more just society, it isn't going to work in the medium to long term, which is really what we want. And the reason is really simple. Let's say best case scenario, I decide to use guilt and shame to try to convince a Sanders supporter to vote for Biden, suck it up, and vote lesser of two evils. Or let's say, prior to the sort of fait accompli of Biden getting the nomination, I had been a Bernie supporter. By the way, I did vote for Bernie Sanders in the Tennessee primary, but I was never a hardcore bought-in acolyte. So let's say I had been a hardcore Sanders supporter, and I had used guilt and shame on a Biden supporter and said, "Oh, you don't care about people dying from lack of insulin. You don't care about the tens of thousands of people who die because they don't have Medicare for all." And let's say that that worked in either direction, right? Either side using guilt and shame to get the other side to vote for their person. In the short run, maybe I can change your voting behavior and get you to do what I want you to do. In the privacy of that voting booth, you go in and you pull the lever, you push the button because you remember that guilt and shame that person made you feel. But let me ask you a question. After Election Day, when all that's done, are you going to want to, as a result of my having done that to you, are you going to want to continue to build with me? Are you going to want to come to the organizing meeting when a bunch of us are sitting down talking about next steps? Are you going to want to get together with people who sought to make you feel shitty about the way that you were leaning and wanted to make you feel just enough shame to where you'd change? And now you did change, but now you got to figure out, like, well, is that the group I want to throw down with? Is that the group I want to hang out with? No, you're not going to want to hang out with people who you think are going to continue judging you, right? Because the minute that you then step into that space, you know what some of us are going to do, right? The person who we guilt or shame into coming on board with our thing, when they then come to hang out and to build with us, if they do, which is a huge if, what's going to happen? Are they going to admit, well, they used to be a Biden supporter, but they voted for Bernie, or they used to be a Bernie supporter, but they sucked it up and voted for Biden? And then when they come and talk about who they used to be before we shame them into changing, then we're going to shame them some more. We're going to shame them for ever having been in that other place, because that's what sometimes we do. And if you don't believe me, just think about the way we do that right now with Joe Biden. One of the arguments people make against Biden, well, you know, he voted for the Iraq War, right? And if he now says that was a mistake, what do you want somebody to do who makes a horrible, horrible mistake? Do you want them to acknowledge the mistake, or do you want them to double down? If you say, well, you know, he voted for the crime bill, right, now he realizes that was a mistake. Or he used to be opposed to marriage equality. Well, so did Obama, and Obama admitted it was a mistake. At what point do you allow people to grow and to change? You know, Bernie Sanders used to have a much worse record on gun policy, and he changed. He voted for the crime bill, and he acknowledged it was a mistake. We have to allow politicians to make mistakes and then later acknowledge that they made them. Or what's the point of our activism? If is the point of your activism that you can never have been wrong, and or that you have, is there like a minimum amount of time you have to wait 20 years of saying that you were wrong before you can ever open your mouth again or run for office? I mean, what is the statute of limitations on bad decisions? Because sometimes those of us on the left want to act as if, oh, no, if you were ever opposed to marriage equality, we don't want anything to do with you now. Well, then what is the point of our having fought for marriage equality? What is the point of pushing politicians to move in that direction if once they move in that direction, you still kick them in the ass for having to be moved in the first place? What kind of dumbass political activism is that? Well, that's sort of what we do. And so as a result, even if I shame you or guilt you into voting for my person, there comes a point where you're not going to want to keep hanging out with me. You're not going to want to get back in a room with a bunch of people that made you feel shitty in the first place for not already being where they were. So I just think that in that sense, even if guilt and shame can work in the short run, if we're talking about more than just the election, which I think most of us on the left, I hope, are thinking well beyond Election Day, we've got to figure out the politic that's going to bring people in and keep them in, not just get them to do what we want them to do in November and then to hell with them after that. It's also highly unethical to use guilt and shame to try to get folks, to try to get them to do whatever it is you want them to do, whether it's guilting and shaming Bernie hardcore folks to try to ensure that they will, you know, suck it up and vote for Biden, or whether it's convincing Biden people during the primaries that they were terrible, horrible people who don't care about insulin deaths. It's not just that it doesn't work. It's that it's highly unethical to even try it. And the reason that it's unethical is because that guilting and that shaming of people who aren't quite where you are. And by the way, this would also apply to utilizing guilt and shame to try to get conservatives to your side. So it isn't just something that applies within the liberal left. The reason it's unethical to use guilt and shame to try to bring people to your position politically and ideologically is, in order for that kind of approach to be ethical, even remotely so, putting aside practicality, you would have to start with the assumption that the person who sees the world a certain way that they believe to be objectively true somehow earned their wisdom. They earned their vast enlightenment, and that the other person who sees the world differently somehow either isn't smart enough or didn't work hard enough to think it through, and that our judgment of them, our moral judgment, which is what shame and guilt are about, it's about moral judgment, it's not a strategic argument, it's a moral argument, that somehow we are judging them and they deserve our judgment, and we deserve the haughty, self-satisfied praise that we are heaping upon ourselves and others who are like us. It presumes just deserts, that the person being judged, being shamed, being guilted deserves our judgment, our guilt, and our shame, and that we, the enlightened, have earned our place among the enlightened. But the reality is, that isn't the case. And in a weird way, this is like the left-wing equivalent of what right-wing folks do, conservative-leaning folks do, when they talk about self-made people, right? Yeah, we all know, those of us on the left, we've heard, because it's part of the American mythos, right? That in America, anybody can be anything they want to be if they work hard enough. And so you get these folks who say, you know, I never had any help from anybody. I built my business by myself. I'm a self-made millionaire, billionaire, businessman, blah, 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 entrepreneur. I did all of this myself without any help. It's part of the notion of rugged individualism and meritocracy that is really the secular gospel of this country, as I've said many times before. And all of us on the left know that when someone, typically on the right, makes that kind of statement about being self-made and earning what they have, and by extension, earning the right to look down on others who don't have those things because they haven't worked hard enough, we all know to roll our eyes at that bullshit, because we understand a number of things that influence those economic outcomes. We understand that some people are born with various privileges and advantages based on socioeconomics, based on gender and sex and race and nationality. And we also know there are things like luck and good fortune, and people come into your life that influence you, and you have mentors and great teachers. And we understand, you know, most of us on the left, would one of our key premises would be that notion of rugged individuality and meritocracy is largely a myth. But then we turn around and we do the same bullshit. Only we don't do it over money. We understand that no one is self-made in terms of their money and their professional success, but we like to play the same stupid-ass game when it comes to sort of taking credit for our ideological enlightenment and how intelligent we are, and acting like, well, we earned our enlightenment. That rich guy, he didn't earn his money, but I earned my genius, by God. I earned my insights into the horrors of the capitalist system, and all of you who don't see it, well, I have the right to judge you for that. Or I earned my insights into the practical ways of American politics that make me need to vote for Joe Biden. And if you don't see that, then it's because you're an idiot and you haven't done enough homework, i.e. you haven't worked hard enough. Do you see the parallel? It's like looking down on the person who sees the world differently than you and judging them for seeing it differently, saying, well, you haven't done the hard work that I've done to understand these truths. It's incredibly arrogant, and it becomes unethical because you're presuming that they deserve your judgment and you deserve your own self-praise. But the reality is that we all come to our politics as a result of a process over which we don't have complete control, just like a person comes to their wealth through a process over which they do not have complete control. We come to our politics as a result of a number of things. Number one is upbringing. And I don't just mean parental influence. Actually, one of the things that's most revealing in the research around ideology is that young people are actually more influenced by their peer group than they are by their own parents. Now, there is some, correlation between those two things, in large part because we have created sort of these silos, geographic and neighborhood type community silos, where people who think right wing tend to sort of gather in certain types of spaces, and people who think more left tend to gather in certain types of spaces. So a lot of times there is a correlation between what your parents believe and what your friend group believe. But when you disentangle them, the peer group has a huge influence. Well, you don't have any control over either the parents that you're born to or the peer group that you're going to have. We're also influenced by teachers, starting at a very early age, who might expose us to certain things. And I'm not even talking about, teachers who sat us down and like preached politics to us. I'm just talking about teachers that expose you to certain thinking, teachers that expose you to the whole process and concept of critical thought. Not everybody's had that teacher, right? Not everybody's had a class where you discuss that kind of stuff. I went to a high school where we actually had a class called critical thinking. How often does that happen? Not that often. So we can't control our families, and our families influence our politics and our leanings. We can't really have control over our peer group at an early age, but that has an influence over what we think and what we see and don't see. We can't really influence the schools that we go to for the most part. Our parents make those decisions typically, so we don't have a lot of influence over that. And then, if you come to your politics like a lot of folks because of research that you did, well, you probably didn't just wake up and think to yourself, I think I'm going to maybe I'm going to read Bakunin today or whatever, right? There's somebody opened your eyes to certain ideas and maybe encourage you to do a little homework and to, hey, you ought to look at this and you ought to think about that. It might have been a friend who turned you on to somebody on YouTube. All right. It might have been somebody that said, hey, you really should read this book. It's a great book. Might be a college professor. We've all had people come into our lives that have encouraged our intellectual development, just like that quote unquote self-made millionaire slash billionaire had people come into their lives that encouraged them to pursue whatever it is they pursued that ultimately made them very wealthy. It's a very similar concept. It is a process with lots of stops and starts along the way, lots of links in the chain. And for those of us who develop a certain belief system, to then get haughty about that, to then get arrogant about that, dispense with humility and instead dispense upon others guilt and shame for not seeing it the way we do, is like saying that we earned our insights rather than we were just lucky to have somebody who opened us up to these kinds of concepts. I know for me, I know exactly where my politics come from. I would love to tell you that, well, I think the way I think because I'm right. Don't you know that? It's because I'm right. I'm just really smart and I did all the homework, and by God, this is objectively true. But no one comes to their politics that way. There's research on this, right? The research says that we don't, by and large, come to our politics as a result of some objective process of investigation and discovery. A lot of it is obviously environmentally influenced by family and friends and the environment in which we grew up. It's also, to some extent, biological. I know that might strike people as frightening, and it is to a degree. It's not that biology's destiny, but there are certain biochemical processes and neurological processes that dispose people to right-leaning or left-leaning politics, just in terms of the structure of the brain. And a lot of that research is sort of in its infancy, but it all points to a certain degree of biological, not determinism, but biological influence for sure. So you have all this stuff going on that you don't have any control over, and that's what brings you to the place that you end up. We all have certain predispositions, and those are inherited from a long history of ourselves and where we come from and who we've been around. And for me, I had parents who were, both liberal Democrats. I was much to their left by the time that I went to college. And once I was in college, I was exposed to a lot of things in the city of New Orleans and a lot of amazing mentors in the activist community and anti-racism, racial equity community there, who had a significant influence and encouraged me to think about things that I had not thought about before, encouraged me to read certain things, to investigate certain things. I worked in public housing as a community organizer for about 15 months in the early to mid 90s and met people that if I hadn't met them, My understanding of the issues of race and class and the way that they intersect with sex and gender wouldn't have been as strong. It would have been a sort of merely academic understanding. That is part of how I came to where I am. I don't have the right to then be smug with someone who hasn't had those experiences, who hasn't had, I would say, the privilege of those experiences, the benefit, the gift of those experiences, or the fact that even going back to my earliest childhood, as many of you know, I went to a preschool early childhood education program at a historically black college on the other side of town from where I grew up in Nashville. I went to Tennessee State University for their early childhood ed program. So I was, you know, being exposed to an environment, educational environment, where most of the kids were black. Most of the educators and professionals who ran that program were African-American women. If I'm not exposed to black authority and black female authority in particular at the age of 3 and 4, am I going to be as likely to be open to hearing black women's authority when I'm working in public housing with a lot of the leadership in those communities, which were and are African-American women, when they're telling me about their lives? Am I going to respond as readily to them, or am I going to be defensive when they're telling me about the way the world works? Well, because of my experience as a kid, I might be in a place to hear them that I wouldn't have been had it not been for that experience. But I certainly don't have the right to then be smug about those experiences or be judgmental and guilt trip you or shame you for not having had them and therefore not seeing what I see. And so in the case of this election, for Bernie supporters to shame and guilt Biden supporters for not caring about people dying because of lack of Medicare for all, or for Biden supporters to try to shame Bernie supporters into holding their nose and voting for Biden when some among them are threatening not to do that, is to assume that your greater enlightenment as a Bernie supporter or as a Biden supporter is somehow earned, and that the lack of enlightenment among those you're trying to persuade is a result of their own horribleness, their own venality, their own inferiority, ethically, not just intellectually, but ethically, because when you're using guilt and shame, it's not an intellectual argument, it's a moral and ethical argument. You're saying you're a bad person for thinking this way. And if you had the same level of ethics and decency and intellect, I suppose, as I do, you would see it my way, as if somehow you've earned that insight. But if you're a Bernie supporter who understands all these things, for instance, about some of the ecological issues that are embedded in the Green New Deal and in the anti-fracking movement, and that's one of the things, you know, some of the folks in the Sunrise Movement are on Biden's case about not wanting to ban fracking, and there's a big debate about natural gas and a big debate about the Green New Deal, and there are a lot of people who don't have the language to engage in that conversation and don't understand the criticality of that particular subject matter, but it's not because they aren't capable of it, and it's not because they don't care. It's because for whatever reason, they have not been exposed to the same analysis, they have not read the same things, seen the same things, or had the same mentors who came into their lives and encouraged them to look at that issue as seriously as some of the Bernie supporters do. But why would you shame somebody for that? Why wouldn't you instead try to present the information to them and give them the gift that someone else gave you? Because if you're going to judge someone for not being where you are, I mean, it's like, how the hell are you going to judge somebody on Thursday for not knowing some shit that you didn't know until Tuesday, right? Like, figuratively speaking, you just learned this shit like a week ago, and now you're going to jump down someone else's throat because they don't know it? But you just learned it. Imagine where you were before you learned it, because all of those folks now who were so enthusiastic about Bernie Sanders, I mean, there was a time that they'll even say, like, this is what turned them on to politics. It's what got them excited about politics. So before the Sanders movement, they weren't paying as close attention. Now they are. Okay, well, how would they have felt if the week before they discovered the grandeur of Bernie Sanders, someone had said, what kind of asshole are you? You don't care about polar bears? What? You don't care about insulin deaths? What? You don't care about police violence in black communities? You probably would have been like, what the hell? How do you know what I care about? Well, exactly. And then you turn around and do the same shit to Biden folks. Or on the other hand, Biden folks who say, well, you know, I just from all of my experience, I've seen how we have to be willing to compromise and the importance of incrementalism. Okay, I might agree with that, but you can't get haughty about it. You can't take that insight that you feel you have about incrementalism, which in your mind mitigates against Bernie and in favor of Biden or whatever, and then use that like a bludgeon on people who don't see it that way, because even if you're right, The insight that you have about incrementalism is not the result of your superior ethics, your superior morality, or even your superior intellect. It's because of your experiences, your experience looking at living in America, looking at American politics, maybe studying that subject, lead you to believe that this is the proper approach. But if that is the case, well, who exposed you to that reality? Who took you under their wing and taught you how to analyze that? Who encouraged you to even care and to think about that stuff and to pay close attention to it and to develop an analysis around it? Who's been your teacher and your mentor in that regard? Might have been a college professor, might have been a high school teacher, may have been a parent, may have been a friend. Like, you can't get ego-driven about that either. Because even if you have obtained some insights as a result of just living, well, you know, the fact that you just lived a while longer and maybe you're a little older and maybe a little more experienced than some of the hardcore base of younger supporters that are behind Bernie Sanders, what, you think you deserve credit for just living longer? You just got born first. Like, what, you didn't earn that. No differently than the, you know, millionaire or billionaire who got into the pipeline in some corporate setting, you know, 20 years before someone else did because they were men and women didn't have the same opportunities, or because they were white and people of color didn't have the same opportunities. The fact that they've been around longer and they're going to use that to justify what? Their higher salary. Well, I've been working for this job for 20 years, so I'm obviously more qualified than you because you've only been there for 10. Well, you know, if you're in the pipeline first, you're supposed to have seniority. It doesn't necessarily mean you're better. Same here. Just the fact that you lived longer than someone. I mean, I'm 51 years old, be 52 in October. That doesn't mean that I automatically know more about certain subjects than someone that's half my age. Or less, right? If it's not a subject that I have focused on specifically, I'm not in the position. Greta Thunberg, I guarantee, knows more about the climate and climate science and climate politics than I do. And she's, what is she, 16? She's certainly inestimably more well-informed than I am. So the simple fact of living longer, yeah, it does correlate with a certain degree of knowledge about how things work, but it's not causal. And we don't have the right, even if we are right in believing that we've gained some insights over the years, that still does not confer upon people the right to use guilt and shame against others any more than it gives them the right to use guilt and shame on us. So we need instead, because it doesn't work and it's unethical, we need to have some gratitude and we need to have some humility. What might that look like? And specifically for Biden supporters in terms of how they interact with Sanders folk and Sanders folk in terms of how they interact with Biden supporters. Let's start with what I think is probably the easier point to make, and that is the gratitude that Biden supporters need to be willing to extend to Sanders' hardcore base voters. Because remember, they are now the ones, after all, who are in the position of needing something from the hardcore Bernie camp. The Bernie camp doesn't particularly need anything from Biden and the Democrats in the sense of this election, because so far as Sanders is concerned, it's over for him. The Sanders hardcore base would say they do want something and do need something from Biden and the Democrats in terms of, you know, helping to get their vote. But that still puts the ball in the court of the Biden folks, right? Ultimately, it leaves it up to the Biden campaign and the Democratic Party in terms of how they are going to approach Sanders folks. And clearly the guilt and shame approach isn't going to work, in addition to it, as I said, being unethical. So what is the way that they ought to approach? And by the way, I don't mean to just suggest this as a cynical political strategy. This is just the way to treat people. This is just the way to go about the business of doing political outreach among potential allies. And that is to show gratitude for what the Sanders campaign, what Sanders himself, and what his supporters have done in the last 4 years, really going back to the 2016 campaign and extending into the 2020 campaign. I think we can all agree, I hope we can, that anyone who considers themselves to be remotely progressive could acknowledge that regardless of how you feel about Bernie Sanders as an individual or the hardcore base of his movement, that we do owe a debt of gratitude to Sanders and the movement for pushing the envelope of what is acceptable within mainstream Democratic Party discourse to the left. This is something that many of us have been trying to do for decades. Reverend Jackson was able to accomplish some of that in his 1984 and 1988 campaigns for the presidency that many of us remember and some of us worked on or supported. So to the extent that Bernie Sanders and the movement of the last 4 years over two campaigns has been able to do that, has been able to move what we call the Overton window, right? Move the envelope to the left. That is a huge service to the cause of progressive politics. And anyone who considers themselves even remotely progressive ought to be grateful for that. I mean, the notion that Medicare for all is even being discussed, right? I mean, during the Obama years, around the time of the conversation regarding the Affordable Care Act, even the discussion of a public option within the Affordable Care Act was off the table. Not just the conversation about a public program, period, with maybe a private option, which is what the debate is centered around now, right? But then it was, what are you talking about? Public option? We can't even utter those words. And here we are, basically a decade later, and we're talking about how much of the system is going to be made public and how quickly. So that is pretty significant. I realize it's not significant enough for a lot of the hardcore Bernie supporters, and I realize that, you know, there are thousands upon thousands of people who are suffering right now for lack of that program, but you can't sort of turn your nose up at how important that has been. So I think we need to thank folks for pushing those issues. Same thing with issues of college debt and affordability and issues of a wealth tax. I mean, we were not talking about these things 4 and 8 and 12 years ago. When Barack Obama was elected president, no one was really talking seriously about a wealth tax in a way that anybody thought was going to go anywhere, or talking about something like a Green New Deal. This is stuff that the Sanders campaign and the Sanders movement have made mainstream. And I think everyone who is on Team Progressive, I don't care what iteration of that, ought to be saying thank you for keeping the foot on the gas and maintaining our focus on these issues of inequality and injustice. This is important stuff. And certainly, if you want a Sanders hardcore base voter to be willing to vote for a much more compromised candidate, you absolutely, from a strategic perspective, damn well better be willing to say thank you. And damn well better be willing to demonstrate your willingness, if Joe Biden becomes president, to maintain the pressure that those folks were already trying to put on the system. Because if you're not willing to join, I mean, it has to be reciprocal, right? If you want them to join you and do the quote-unquote right thing in November, you better be damn well prepared to join them and push for a more progressive reality moving forward. Has to be a two-way street. And that's how gratitude can be expressed on that end. On the other end, I know it might seem a lot harder. If I'm a hardcore Bernie supporter, what gratitude do I need to have for some neoliberal, you know, Joe Biden supporter who's willing to vote for someone whose views are so retrograde, in my opinion? Well, let me start by saying this. Just as a whole lot of people, millions of voters in this country, were politicized and even radicalized by Bernie Sanders as a candidate and the narrative of Bernie Sanders and the movement behind Bernie Sanders. And they'll tell you that first time they really came into political awareness, and it's been this huge revelatory, amazing thing for them. Well, you know, that's great. And there are millions of Americans who were politicized and radicalized by the election of Donald Trump too, by the election of that man. And for 4 years, they have been fighting the good fight, trying to figure out how to not only win elections during the midterms, but then ultimately how to replace Donald Trump with someone else in 2020 and beyond. And even if they are not quite where you are as a hardcore Sanders supporter, a hardcore leftist, the fact that they have become animated in the last 4 years by the dangers which they too didn't see, just like a lot of the Sanders supporters didn't see the problem until it was pointed out to them very clearly by Bernie Sanders. Well, a lot of people didn't realize the dangers until it was pointed out to them directly or indirectly by the actions of Donald Trump. In both cases, you've got people who have come to awareness, and just as we ought to be grateful for those young folks in particular who got turned on to progressive politics and issues of social justice because of the Sanders narrative, we also want to be grateful for, and the Sanders folks themselves ought to also be grateful for, those individuals who came into a politicization and even first or second step radicalization by the actions of Donald Trump. That is also a politicized base that we need to be grateful for, and that was not there in millions of cases before the election of Donald Trump. Same thing as the millions who weren't there before the political movement led by Bernie Sanders. And if I'm a hardcore Sanders supporter, I ought to be willing to look at those folks and be grateful that they're out there fighting the good fight, even if I think they might be doing it in a somewhat naive way. You know, I remember when the Women's March took place, and, you know, here you had, millions of people around the United States marching in tandem. And a lot of us, you know, sort of looked askance at some of that. I know a lot of people that were involved in the organizing of the march, and I think it was, on the one hand, a really amazing act of solidarity and a really important moment, but we did make a little bit of fun of it, and I now regret doing that. Like, there was some fun that was made of people making fun of sort of the implicit white feminism. You know, there were a lot of memes that went around about all these white feminists who had just discovered injustice and how they weren't sufficiently intersectional, and I get all of that. And that's not wrong, by the way. I mean, that criticism was understandable. But at the same time, like, we don't have the luxury of being judgmental in that moment. If there are millions of people who all of a sudden see a threat, the fact that they didn't see the threat as early as I saw the threat, or as early as you saw the threat, or as early as somebody else saw the threat, once again, like, okay, well, you want to be haughty about that? You want to be egotistical about that? You want to be judgmental about that? You know, you want to claim some superiority? Once again, you know, that's just sort of shitty behavior. That's not helpful. So the fact that you've come into a certain level of awareness, whenever you come to it, I've got to be there to embrace you. And if I want you to move from where you are at that sort of initial 101 level to a 201, 301 graduate level, right, then I've got to work with you. And I can't just sit there and be all arrogant and smug about how much more I know and how much quicker I knew it. And I think that's sort of where we are right now, right, is doing that kind of bullshit on the left. And so I think in this case, the Sanders supporters, if they're trying to build a more just world, and they are going to need, I hate to use this language, they're going to need the raw material of bodies and people out there putting themselves on the line. And where are those people likely to come from? Are those people likely to come from the ranks of, you know, the totally disaffected people who are not paying any attention at all, people who are just sitting around, you know, watching reality television and playing video games and picking their nose and not caring about politics at all? Not likely. I mean, if you're going to, in fact, draft an army of people to join you within the left, within the Sanders type left, you're probably going to start with the people who are, you know, Democratic Party activists and were Kamala Harris supporters and were, you know, Julian Castro supporters and Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg and even Joe Biden supporters. I mean, that's where your raw material is going to come from. That's where your movement material is going to come from. So you need to express gratitude for them being, you know, 1/10 of the way to where you want them to be, or 1/5 or 1/4 or 1/3 or 1/2 or whatever it is, because they're the ones who at least have taken a few steps in the direction that you believe they need to go. And if you don't express gratitude, again, not only are you being arrogant in a way that's unethical, it's completely strategically inept. Whereas a little bit of gratitude expressed for the fact that they already have a commitment to eradicating Trumpism as a political force means that these are folks that the left, the real left, if they want to call themselves that, ought to be prepared to work with. And if you're not willing to work with those folks and express gratitude for them, then what you're doing is just saying that you are comfortable with obscurity and marginality and the badge of honor that comes from being right, as opposed to being successful. Some people are more concerned about being right than they are about winning. Some people are more concerned about having the right ideological line than they are being effective. And those are people who are toxic to political organizing and social movements. They need to be ignored, whether they are Biden folks or Bernie folks or whatever the case might be. We've got to figure out how to work together in this moment. And that is going to mean considerably less guilt, considerably less shaming, and a significant uptick in the focus on expressing gratitude to our potential allies and people that we're trying to work with, and humility around how we came to whatever enlightenment we think we have come to. And if we can do that, we stand a chance to not only defeat Trumpism, but to move forward and build real movements for social justice, liberation, and solidarity across the board in this country. Too much is at stake to allow guilting and shaming and performative radicalism to get in the way of that deeper project. And that'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Follow the show on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Instagram.
higher and the mightier, liars and the righteous, fighting for their life, get organized and gather around. Such a city's catch fire and the flames grow higher and the poor and the pious get it.